we also have to recognize what we've been through, because while we were going through it, we couldn't really ease up. And then as things ease up, what can come bubbling up is all the stress and anxiety and sadness that we experience.
Hey, I'm Kelly Corrigan, and this week I've been wondering about my family, and yours too, how each of us might be feeling as the culture inches its way into this new relationship with COVID-19. I wonder if it's harder for us to look forward to the future, or trust public figures, or feel safe. I wonder if we're carrying judgments around about who wore a mask, who hoarded toilet paper, who threw a party. I wonder if permanent damage has been done to our outlooks and relationships, or if we are on the verge of the summer of love. Long hugs, brimming parks, music festivals, cookouts, proper weddings. Today's conversation with therapist Karen Moon will help us process what's happened so that we can get our heads right as we launch into the big days ahead. This is Kelly Corrigan Wonders, and we'll be right back after a short break. Before we get started with Karen Moon, a therapist for adolescents, I wanted to make two big meta points. One, the range of suffering in the past year is pretty wide. For 578,000 families, the loss was permanent. Today, we're thinking about teenagers and college kids, but this is, of course, only one group of many we could zero in on as we get ready to transition to what my guest calls the summer of healing. And as is true of most good ideas, her observations and suggestions are applicable to many other groups as well. Two, not every kid hated every part of the pandemic every day. Some were relieved not to have to figure out who to sit with at lunch or what to wear every day. Kids who have ambivalent feelings about sports were happy to miss the season. Kids who had unsatisfying social lives got a break from rejection. Homebodies had more time to veg out, and introverts, which is a hard thing to be as an adolescent, got a break. But the great derailing messed with all of us in one way or another, and there are changes to name and understand, and that's why I wanted to talk to Karen Moon about the thousands of hours she's spent this year talking to young people, or I should say listening to young people, so that we might more easily recognize the losses they're working through and the ways they might be languishing and the doubt and mistrust that might be lingering. So, hey, Karen, thanks a lot for saying yes.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here, Kelly.
So you really gave me a sense the other day when we were chatting about how to get ready for this summer and how to parent my kids through this moment. So can you talk a little bit about your point of view and where you get it? Like, what's your work that's giving you this perspective?
Sure. So I'm in private practice. My specialty is grief and loss. But about 10 years ago, I got my first adolescent client, and that became my other specialty. And my adolescents have morphed into college students in mid-20s, which, as we know, is really still adolescence.
Though we wish it weren't.
Yes, trying on different hats and changing and making decisions. And I think about a quarter of my clients right now are college students, and I learn everything I know from my clients. And I've really been taking note of what these college kids have been going through.
So let me ask, interestingly, before you went into private practice, you worked for, was it Merrill Lynch?
Yes. So I got my graduate degree in social work, and I was fortunate enough to get a job at Merrill Lynch. Kind of odd to say a social worker is working at Merrill Lynch, but I worked in their employee assistance program, and I worked with employees of all different levels with all different issues. And then whenever there was a tragedy and there was an office, they would send one of us to go work with the employees. So I went to Oklahoma City after the bombing. I went to Littleton after the Columbine shooting. And then, of course, after 9/11, I did a lot of work. And what I came to really understand and appreciate is that people, when they experience difficulties and adversity, want to tell their story and have someone listen without fixing or without trying to change it or talk them out of it and just hear the story. And so when I think about our kids this year and all that they've been going through, and most specifically, I think about the college kids and what they did in returning to college campuses. They all buttoned up and they went back to an ever-changing landscape after leaving school last year in March so quickly. And they pivoted and found unique ways to remain connected. They embraced going deeper with current friendships rather than expanding their circle of friends. Academically, they adapted to learning via Zoom classes and spending hours in front of the computer. And I think they've held it together. All, you know, high school kids, college kids, all of us. And we've lived under incredible stressful circumstances, more specifically with the college kids, without any adult supervision and limited support.
You know, it's interesting. What I'm taking away from what you're saying is that an important step to take for all of us as we transition from one phase of this pandemic to a new phase is to recognize what we've been through, to articulate what we've been through, and to pat ourselves on the back.
Yeah, beautifully said. Yes, and recognize it. There's no fixing what we went through, but there is recognizing. And, you know, they're talking about like happy days are here again and everything's going to be great. We're getting back to normal. And that is great. But we also have to recognize what we've been through, because while we were going through it, we couldn't really ease up. Whenever you're in a stressful situation, you have to hold yourself together, all of us. And then as things ease up, what can come bubbling up is all the stress and anxiety and sadness that we experienced in the past year. It sort of reminds me of, you remember the old fable of the little Dutch boy with his finger in the dike? Mm-hmm. You know, I think we all kept our finger in the dike because we were afraid if we took our finger out and really felt what we were feeling, we might get flooded. So now there's no more flooding, but we let the finger out and we start to really feel it. And we just need to recognize it and be able to hear each other.
You know what's so interesting? I am a lacrosse coach for freshman and sophomore girls. And we just had the end of the year party. And it was a really special season, as you can imagine, like just being outside every night with living, breathing other people, watching growth was like the perfect antidote to 12 months hunched over a laptop reading about cancellations and restrictions. And when I tried to say my final words about the season for the girls, I burst into tears. So I got flooded. I took my finger out of the dike for a second. And I thought, oh my God, this must be how everyone's feeling at some level. What I was trying to say to them is, this was so special for me. Like, you guys saved me from this damn pandemic. Like, watching you run and laugh in the open air under the lights was like sublime. But I couldn't get it out because it had been so much heavier on me than I would have even known had I not tried to name it. So it's understandable to me that people might be hesitant to sort of enumerate the ways in which they felt anxiety or stress or felt suppressed during all this time because they're afraid they're just going to burst into tears and fall apart at the seams, which is exactly what I did in front of 15-year-olds.
Which is beautiful. It's beautiful modeling and being real. You know, we live in a culture that doesn't pay a lot of attention and is very fearful of grief. And that's what this is.
Isn't it interesting that your work with Merrill Lynch probably prepared you to help people through this moment?
Completely. I think the lessons I learned after 9/11 really helped me. And Merrill Lynch, let me just backtrack, was not in the World Trade Center. It was in the World Financial Center. So it was right next door. And I had a circle of people around a table talking about their experiences. And one man stood up and he said, and he explained from the beginning, from when he was sitting at his desk and he got the phone call to say, get out of the office. And he ran down the stairs. He was at the marina looking over the water. He explained how it smelled, how the people were screaming, and then it was silent, and the second plane went right past him. so close that he could almost see the people in the window, and he watched the impact on the second tower. And then he ran, and he got on a boat, and he got over to New Jersey, and he looked at all of us when he was finished, and he said, "Thank you." He said, "Nobody wants to really hear my story. It's too painful. It's too painful for people to hear." And I see that left and right with grief all the time. And we just want to tell our story and be heard and seen.
Well, it's funny. I bet people feel hesitant to take up space on this pandemic thing for two reasons. One is because they may feel that they've had it better than most, mm-hmm. so that they're not really ranking in the hierarchy of suffering. And two is everybody went through it. So aren't we just going to be repeating ourselves?
Right. And I don't know if you ever saw this poem. It was all over Facebook. You know, we're all in the same storm, but we're on a different boat. And some of us are on lifeboats, and some of us are on yachts, and some of us are drowning.
But that could really clam people up, and that's not helpful.
Yes. Yes. Comparative suffering is not helpful.
Yeah. So as people start to transition, give us some ideas about how we can be helpful to each other.
I think the best way to be helpful is to be open and to listen and to not, like, I think in our culture, we tend to be like, oh, it's going to be good. Let's look at the future. Let's look at the future. It's all going to get better. And there's no time or there's no space to complain or say, geez, that really hurt. And some of my favorite moments when I'm working with a client is when they're sitting on my couch and I'm sitting across from them and I ask them a question about a story that's inside of them, like the story of what it was like to be in my dorm room 8 hours a day staring at the same four walls. And they pull the story out and it lays naked between us. And I may ask some questions and poke and prod, but my favorite moments is when I don't even say anything brilliant and the client says, "Wow, you know what? I never thought about it this way. Like, I actually did pretty well with this." And then it goes back in just a little lighter with some different meaning and perspective. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think we need to offer up to each other, is space to be able to talk about the meaning of what happened to us last year.
Talk about some of your observations about what has been particularly hard for college students. Like, one thing that you mentioned that I had never thought about was that they're not really in contact with the adults in their life.
So what I'm seeing with these college kids, I wanted to share with all of you. I want to sort of just paint the picture of what I've gathered of what kids have been experiencing. And anybody who's a parent of a college kid knows bits and pieces, but sometimes you don't know the whole story. And I'm not suggesting, there are some kids that have been just fine, and there are other kids who have really, really struggled. But I also want to recognize that even the kids who seem to be just fine and have pivoted really well, it still was a big change for them and for you as parents. Mm-hmm. So, and I think it helps when we are being curious with our kids and asking them that we try to get an understanding of what they've endured. So yes, the big piece that I came up with is this decreased connection with peers and adults. And we know about the peers, but the adults really struck me. And, you know, there was no like really getting to know your professor or getting to know your advisor or the person who serves you dinner every night or the crossing guard on your college campus. And to think that a lot of these kids are going either to college for the first time or just in their second or third year during a world crisis with no adult support or supervision, really. I think about a boy that I worked with years ago in high school, and he was having a really hard time. And his baseball coach recognized this and then gave him all kinds of different jobs and invited him into his class to help him out with cleaning up his classroom. And that boy just like burst open because he was seen, and he was seen by an adult in this huge public high school where he felt very invisible.
Yeah. And I mean, this comes up in a lot of different ways in a lot of conversations I have, like with Brian Stevenson, the great civil rights attorney. We talked a lot about proximity mm-hmm. and knowing people's names and knowing their story and knowing more about them than their crime. I really feel like that the number one thing that people want is to feel they've been felt. And mm-hmm. sometimes the way that that happens is through face-to-face contact. And so when you remove that, you're in danger of missing so much about a person. Like Jen Garner and I are friends, sorry to name drop, but she does a lot of work with Save the Children. And she was super scared when they stopped sending the buses around to each house to pick up the kids, because she said that's how they learned so much about who needed what, was just laying eyes on the kids with their parents, sensing the dynamics, checking for lice, seeing if the house was like upright or if they had a broken window, you know, all the kinds of things that you can observe. Melinda Gates talked about observation and being on the ground. And so that loss of eyes on you is super dangerous for kids. Not only super lonely feeling, but also kind of dangerous. Like it introduces the possibility that we would miss something. I mean, I had several players on my team who would tell me things about their family life or about what was going on in their classes. And I thought, you never would have texted me that. You wouldn't have emailed me that. You wouldn't have put that in writing. It's only because we're together face-to-face 10 hours a week that you even feel comfortable telling me that.
Yeah, because there's a relationship there. And you wouldn't do that over Zoom either.
No.
And I've certainly experienced that with, you know, I'm seeing about half of my clients over Zoom now and half in person. And the Zoom, I have to be kind of extra skillful there to really try to know and understand and feel the person. And it just doesn't go through the internet as well as it does in person.
Yeah. And the other thing about, like, you know, the person who checks your meal card in the cafeteria or whatever, that little network of weak ties is actually in total kind of a powerful feeling of being known, being a part of something, being welcome here, being safe.
Yes. And I think we've all missed that. But I think especially for these kids starting a new life back on a college campus, that is a completely different landscape than the one they left or the one they anticipated.
Another thing you talked about that I thought was interesting, and I had never thought about it before, but it's come up in other ways on this podcast, is the kind of liminal spaces where you're commuting, for instance, or you're transitioning from classes and you walk outside for 15 or 20 minutes and you pass five people and give them a high five. And, you know, there's a sense of community there. Whereas this is just turn off one Zoom and open another.
Yeah. The fact that like some of these kids are spending all day, the way that any of us who have been lucky enough to work from home are spending all day in one office. But during this very important developmental time of life, they're stuck in these four walls. And there's not that transition where you're moving your body, you're saying hi, you're looking at the sky. And especially for kids who live in cold areas, this winter was especially challenging with that. And the other thing is, I think, you know, is for, especially for kids in college, just not having that alone time to be in this really small room and sharing it with a roommate that you may or may not get along with. And if you're at all introverted and need to refill your bucket, there's no place to do that. There's no library. There's no coffee shop. There's no dining hall to go and kind of put your headsets on and just refill yourself.
Yeah, that sense of like your bed is the sum total of your personal space.
Yeah.
You know, like that's really what it is. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of grim. Yeah.
It's really grim. And, you know, different colleges were different. I mean, I know some of these small liberal art colleges in the middle of nowhere who really had to lock things down, like really lock things down, that there was nothing open except for your dorm. And, you know, you'd go pick up your meal and go back to your dorm room and eat the meal. At least in the fall, you could be outside and do it. But this winter was really tough.
Yeah.
And not having any escape either of going home. You know, I mean, I knew plenty of kids who did some fancy footwork and kind of finagled their way to come home for a weekend, but usually we're breaking the rules to do that.
Well, that gets to this other thing, which is this feeling of a police state where people are judging and each other about how they're doing the pandemic.
Yeah, I think that was one of my most disturbing experiences this fall, was the lack of trust that these kids felt, not only with the administration or their college, but with each other, and that kids were turning on each other or not feeling safe and not feeling yourself heard. If you were somebody who were really uncomfortable with going out to a party or quote unquote breaking the rules, but your roommate was okay with that, that felt really unsafe and disrespected. And vice versa, if you're the kid who wants to go out, but you come home to feeling a lot of judgment or possibly getting turned in, feels terrible. And you came to this school and you trusted these adults, and I'm not blaming the colleges because I don't really know any other way they could have done it. But the consequences of some of your actions were really extreme, from getting kicked out of, getting kicked out of the dorms and having to go home, to, losing privileges.
Yeah. And we're not that good. I mean, even when things are normal, we're not that good at having a nice open debate where everybody feels that they can state their case and be heard, but also isn't so wrapped up in their own position that they can't even let in an alternative idea. Like, we're not that great at that, period. But yeah, there's like, to try to do that in a closed world where you're on Zoom, like, that can't possibly.
Exactly. Yes. And I just think, it for kids who like to follow the rules, following the rules was so constricting and depressing. And then to break the rules feels really uncomfortable and can bring up a lot of anxiety. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot what I saw.
Yeah. We have people know that in their own families too, where if you have more than one child or even just the two people in the couple, that it's likely that you'll have slightly different ideas about what's okay and what's not okay. And then you're pitted against each other, even in your own house. Like, one of my kids had friends who were very serious about containing the virus. And one of my kids had friends who were like trying to throw a party the night that the schools got closed. And I was negotiating between the two of them. I was trying to say, like, listen, I can see both sides. I can see that, like, if you're a kid and you've been in this thing for 12 months and you don't know one person who's gotten COVID, or 20 people have gotten COVID, but nobody got sick, it's going to be hard for you to take it seriously. Like, and I understand that if your friends will not hang out with you because your sister's partying, that's really hard too.
Yeah, really hard. And then I think our kids also really experience hypocrisy too, of, there's people who follow the rules and then suddenly they change their mind with the rules when they want to do something. So that can be confusing and inconsistent. And that's the other thing. I think our kids and all of us have been living with this inconsistency, and the rules are changing all the time. I actually found that from March till May, when we were really in lockdown, in a lot of ways that was easier because there was one rule, like, everybody stay inside, just go to the grocery store, wash your groceries. But then as things started loosening up and lightening up, everybody had different interpretations of the rules. And that's really confusing for adults, let alone for kids.
Yes. And within families, my one brother's in Baltimore, another brother's in Philly, my mom's in Philly, and I'm out in California. And those three locations had different kind of ethos around the pandemic. So sometimes I felt like a freak. And then the other thing I would feel is it would undo my position a little bit. Like, I would have a conversation with myself and think, like, are we overdoing it? Like, is this ridiculous? Yeah. I think for an adult, that's a really hard thing to realize. It's like, oh my God, what if the people in charge don't really know what they're doing? Like, that's an unsettling realization to come to. But if you're 20 and you're like, my university president says this, the governor of my state where I'm from says this, the governor of the state where my school is says this, my aunt does it this way, my uncle does it that way. I mean, that is just too much uncertainty.
Yes. And uncertainty can create stress depending on who you are and what your level of resilience with living with uncertainty. And I think a lot of us have grown from it. We've grown that we can live with uncertainty, but it's not comfortable. And I'm hoping that we're getting more comfortable with it, because the truth of the matter is life has always been uncertain. And I think this pandemic has just shown that. It's kind of lifted the veil and said, you people, you are actually not in charge of your destiny, even though you're in the greatest country in the planet, right?
Right. The other thing, I think, in terms of appreciating what it's feeling like for each person in your family, is I have definitely had to cop to some uncertainty. And it feels so terrible as an adult to not have an answer, to not be a role model, quote unquote. But But that's like another thing that might be really hard for our kids in this is that, like, where are the role models? Who's got the right answer? Like, it's just not at all obvious. Whereas it could have been maybe at this great moment of like national unity, like in some other countries, it was a little bit more, you know, there was one set of rules, everyone followed them. And maybe there was a feeling of patriotism around that, that we're all doing our part, et cetera, et cetera. But here it was just nothing but division.
I mean, it reminds me of you're a kid and your parents are fighting. Like, yes. Who's in charge? You feel so unstable. And at the top of our country, our leadership, we didn't feel stable. I mean, everybody was fighting, which makes us, and it just trickles down to all of us, a feeling like our world has been rocked and there's cracks in it.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking about comparative suffering because I'm thinking about race in America right now. Mm-hmm. And because these two things were happening in really profound ways simultaneously. And it's easy to think in terms as a parent, on some days I feel impatient with these sort of lowercase L losses in a yeah. world where there are so many uppercase L losses. How do you manage that? You know, dismissing real pain in the face of other real pain that is much greater. I mean, there's much, much riskier to be a Black person in America than it is to be, you know, a Division I soccer player. Like, how do you get your head around that?
Because in that person's world, in that Division I soccer player's world, that is her world. And there is room to talk about people starving in Africa. And there's also room to talk about what her loss is. If it's not, if there is shame about it, like your loss is like, really, you're complaining because you didn't get to play soccer and look at these other people, then shame develops and shame is toxic. And what I like to talk about is not necessarily the story, like, oh my God, I didn't get to play soccer. It's the feeling. It's the feeling of the disappointment, of the sadness, of the loss, which is universal for everybody, no matter what story makes that feeling. So I try not to get into the weeds of the story and go right to the feeling, because the feeling is meant to be felt, not the story, even though the story is meant to be heard, but the feeling is meant to be felt.
Yes. And to the extent that people can feel their feelings, they can feel other people's feelings.
Yes. And then empathy increases.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Which is pretty, pretty powerful. Let's pause for a short break and we'll be right back with Kelly Corrigan Wonders. The 10% Happier podcast has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? Hosted by Dan Harris, a journalist who had a panic attack on national television and then set out on a journey of transformation. He's now on a quest to help others also achieve peace and happiness. Every week, Dan talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity in wide-ranging conversations that explore topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. The interviews cover everyone from Brené Brown to Alexander Draymond to Sam Harris. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. Find 10% Happier wherever you listen to podcasts. Hey, welcome back to Kelly Corrigan Wonders. I have really enjoyed being with you on Instagram these past few weeks. There have been some pretty funny discussions at Kelly Corrigan, so meet me there between episodes. All right, let's jump back in with Karen Moon. Do you wish that no one would ever say the best 4 years of your life again?
Yes. I think what we have learned through pandemic is stay present. What is happening right now? I think we put tremendous pressure on kids for these best 4 years of our lives. And I think the other thing that we parents who had the best 4 years of our lives, we really need to recognize that this is not the same college experience that we may have had. And that's okay. I think when change is imposed upon us, we tend to think it's going to be bad. I know when my daughter went back to school this August, I felt sad, like, oh, she's not going to be able to go to tailgates and do all those things that I thought were really fun in college. But then I realized that that doesn't mean that her experience is not going to be great. It just might be different. But don't assume, don't look at her with puppy dog eyes like, oh, you're not going to get this, because she may get something much better.
Yeah, it's funny. That's a feeling I have over and over again as a parent, is like, you really don't know. We just had a daughter go through the college application process. And I thought, you can't say, oh, I love such and such school. Like, what are you basing that on? Like that one girl who sat next to you in algebra who went there, who you didn't really like? Like that, just your information is so old, so thin, and so irrelevant to what they're going through that you should really just keep saying, tell me more. I mean, that's my only go-to thought is just really tell me more. What else? Yeah. Go on. Like when we look at the transcript of our conversation, I should say like 10 words and you should say 1,000.
Right. Yeah. I think, the omnipotence that we feel as parents is such a myth. We are not omnipotent. We don't know what's best for our kids. We may have thoughts and feelings and ideas, but we don't know. And again, I think that's another thing we learned about this pandemic. There's so much we don't know, but we're afraid of the mystery of it. We don't know. I think the greatest gift that we can give our kids of all ages, but most especially our emerging adult children, is that we trust them and that we have faith in them and that we want to know what they're thinking and what they're feeling. And we don't need to tell them that. We just need to listen.
How do you think about the layers of the last year and what they're putting on the minds of our kids? You know, if it's not a global pandemic, which is really just astounding thing to have lived through. I mean, we're all so used to saying it now, but it's crazy. It's so crazy what just happened.
Well, it's crazy too, because we've never been through anything like this. Right. Like we went through 9/11, but we've never, I mean, our generation has not been through a war. Nothing like this.
Yeah. Right. And it happened so fast and you could not be a thinking person and not wonder if it's going to happen again. You could not be a thinking person and wonder what might escape from a lab, since we're playing around with making viruses so that we can study them, et cetera, et cetera. Then you have this racial tension that is so intense and so much learning and so many steps forward, I think, but also just like this continual drumbeat of horrific behavior. And then the third monster layer is the climate. So we're in California. I mean, everybody has their own story of when, what day of their life they realize, like, oh my God, this is climate change. And in California, it's the fires. So, I mean, we've lived here for 25 years. I think we're going to move. Like, I don't think we can live through it again. It was just too heavy. There were too many nights where you wake up in the middle of the night with smoke in your nose and you think something's on fire in your kitchen. And then you find out it's 150 miles away and you can smell it in your house.
Jeez,
it's in your clothes. So those are three really hard to understand and hard to impact situations that are right against our noses every single day. Yeah. So do you have any advice for how families can talk about and think about racial tension, climate destruction, and the pandemic?
That's a big question.
I know, but I figured you might be able to answer it.
Well, I think first and foremost, it's talking about it. And it's talking about it without a lot of fear, but more with acknowledgement that our world order, or what we thought was our world from 10 years ago, is no longer. And to like look back at the things that we have gone through, like we have gotten through this pandemic. For the most part, we're all doing okay. And so the capacity of the human spirit, I think, needs to really be identified and talked about, and decreasing the fear of change, because that's what it's all about. It's fearing the change, but that we are humans and we are built for change. But I think that there's been so much technology and information that we're under the illusion that we can resist change, and we can't.
Right. So it's a little bit of acceptance, a little bit of a celebrating the fact of our resilience over time. You know, I don't think it's overstating it to think about the way that we stopped the Holocaust. I mean, that was horrific. And somehow all of these nations came together to block that. And I feel like when my kids who are, you know, engaging in the world for the very first time and like what a trio of subjects to engage on. Like one is bigger and hairier and scarier than the next. To say, well, there haven't been other really big moments that we have conquered. Let's study what success there has been in protecting each other and creating a more fair world, in recognizing climate change, in adjusting to it, in new policy around policing. I feel like what you're saying is that on the one hand, you just acknowledge it and create space for it. Like this is real and what you're seeing is real and it's heavy. And also serving up reminders that we have survived other things before and that we have improved and that the moral arc bends towards justice.
Exactly. And then I would add a third thing to empower ourselves to do something about it. Because when we feel like change is imposed upon us, we feel unsteady. So face the change, face it, and move towards it and do something about it. And it doesn't mean that you have to, you know, study, you know, social policy. I mean, you can study business and still do something to help our planet or to help the racial inequities or to help the pandemic. But start those conversations and empower our kids to make small and maybe big changes that will address all three of those things.
We had a conversation really early on in Kelly Corrigan Wonders about agency and the powerful sense that of efficacy that even these tiny actions can generate within us. And that if you take enough tiny steps, you start to feel like habitually effective, like you're on a team that's working towards something better. And it's anything from going to protests to posting on social media to learning about who you want to vote for to studying biology and seeing the connections. So that might be another thing that we could do for kids is to point out individuals in the world who are doing interesting things that are helping us move forward on any of these big three issues.
Right. Yes. And I think that's been a really difficult thing with the pandemic, with all that's been happening in our country, is feeling like I can't do anything. I can't really go out. I can't really interact with people to make change. Because we've all been kind of boxed in and watching it on TV. So that's the exciting thing about the pandemic lifting is we can get out and start doing more and doing better.
Yeah. Yeah. When do you know that it's time for your kid or someone in your family to see a therapist?
If you see your child really having some big changes, like really isolating in their room or not eating much or hoarding food or not being able to sleep. Those are kind of obvious that, okay, let's get some professional help in and help you get through that. Then there's many kids that I see who just want to know themselves more, like are recognizing like, this has been really hard and I could really benefit from learning more about myself and talking it out with someone who's not my mom, not my sister, not my friend, and see different perspectives of what my life has been in this past year.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about finding the right therapist? Because I feel like if you were to start therapy and with the wrong person, you might think that is therapy and you might write off the whole enterprise, you know?
Right.
And it's not. It's just your chemistry with that person. It's just like dating or something.
It's completely like dating. It's all about chemistry. I often say this. It's not like going to the dentist. Like you really need to feel safe and comfortable and trusting of the environment and of me. So I think word of mouth is the best way. And, you know, I don't think there's as much stigma now about therapy. So I would talk to your friends and see what their experiences are. I think you will find that there are a lot of teenagers and college kids who have been in therapy or are in therapy. And so I think that word of mouth is the best way. And then you try it out. And I always say this to especially to teenagers. I said, we're going to spend an hour together. And then you're going to go back up to the car to your mom. And if you say to her, that lady was the weirdest lady, I could never talk to her. Done. You never have to see me again. Your mom will call me and we'll find somebody else for you. But it's really, really important that you feel comfortable.
I'm a little hesitant to ask this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you ever feel, sometimes I feel like therapy is indulgent and that it's navel gazing and that maybe you just need to get out there and work a hard day or do some volunteering or help somebody else and stop thinking about yourself? Is that crazy? Is that like so old fashioned and harsh of me?
No, it's not crazy at all. It does feel indulgent because I think we were brought up that way, like pull your bootstraps up and just go work it off. But I believe that we are complex individuals with all of these stories inside of us. And it is a beautiful opportunity to know yourself. And I think the one way to know yourself is in therapy. It doesn't mean you need to be in therapy for a year. I mean, it could be a couple sessions. The other thing that I think is a nice not replacement, but another alternative to therapy is journaling. And that is a beautiful way to know yourself, to set aside 15 minutes every day with your notebook and just write. Don't write about what you're going to do that day, just write whatever is in your head and what is in your heart. And what I think it's pretty amazing because you can look down on the page and be like, oh, wait a minute. I can't believe I'm thinking this way. Or maybe it really wasn't that way. So that same aha moment that I can have with someone on my couch can happen with a journal.
Yeah, because it's just putting the tiniest bit of distance between you and your thoughts.
Yeah.
And there's something about I'm a person who's journaled since seventh grade. Like there's something so funny and revealing about seeing it turn up on the page. And I have all kinds of takeaways when I'm doing that. I think like, God, you would never say that to a friend. Like, don't talk that way to yourself.
Yes,
or like, oh my God, we're looping on the same damn thing that we've been looping on for 30 years. Like, let's just release it.
Yeah. And it takes a lot of courage to journal. And it takes a lot of courage to go to therapy because you're bearing your soul. And most of us want to close up our soul. But there's so much toxicity in all of us human beings when things stay inside. Like if you had never written about the body shaming, it stays inside. And it reminds me of, you know, if you have a rat in your basement and he spends all this time eating up the wires and making a mess. You go downstairs and you shine a light on that rat, it scurries away. So you shine a light on the rats inside of you and they may not scurry away completely, but they change shape.
I mean, they definitely get smaller. Like all things, you know, light is the anecdote.
Yes, light is. And we are so much in our heads, and especially our kids are so much in their heads. And so much on their phones and looking at what other people are doing, that all kinds of crazy stories, I feel like, get conjured up inside that only get untwisted when they're pulled out.
Right, right. You got to lay it out on the table, whether it's in your journal, whether it's to your best friend, whether it's to a therapist.
Yeah.
You got to
confess
the crazy way that you're seeing something.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. To the extent that you are tied in knots, your ability to contribute to the larger world, to be a part of the solution, to be on the world positive team, is hampered. So maybe it's indulgent to get therapy, or maybe it's dispensing with one of the obstacles to contribution. Like maybe knowing yourself better allows you to contribute in much bigger ways.
Oh, completely. I couldn't say that better. And you know, when you're tied up in knots, you can't think straight. You can't create. And we are creative beings that are put on this earth to create and make things better. But if we're spinning inside and tied up in knots, there is no creativity. And
right.
Then there's no contribution. So I think that's beautiful.
Yeah. Karen, thank you so much. Thanks for thinking about this with me. Thanks for helping us be prepared to take good care of each other this summer. I'm super glad we met, and I have a feeling that you'll be back.
Oh, I'd love to. Thanks, Kelly. It's just so important. Just listen to all the parents out there when their kids come home from college this summer. Allow them to kind of fall apart and be curious and listen to their stories. Don't try to just push ahead and say, don't worry, it's over. You'll go to football games next year. Because remember, it's a little anxiety producing. We're all feeling that about going back to big things. So just take time, be patient, and do it with lots of love and openness, and don't be afraid.
Thank you. Before I leave you, as always, I want to give you my takeaways. Today I have 8. Number 1, it's not possible to process during crisis. So if the worst of the pandemic is really just about over, that work will be waiting for us now. 2, comparative suffering is not helpful. The feeling is meant to be felt. In fact, it will be felt, low though you might wish otherwise. 3, kids really need the adults in their life. Coaches, teachers, counselors, bus drivers, cafeteria ladies. We become a certain kind of safety net, and that safety net has been missing this year. 4, unclear direction about what constitutes good civic pandemic behavior has us all turning on each other. There will be work to undo that. 5, expectation defines experience. So let us strike this sentence from the record. Quote, college is the best 4 years of your life. 6, we need commutes to create transition space between home and work, between class and lunch, between friends and family. 7, even though we know everything and could spare them so much heartache, when your kids become a certain age, they start to think of us as irrelevant. 8, to be heard is to be seen, is to be known, and we were meant to know each other.
Coming up next on Kelly Corrigan Wonders.
From decades of research all over the world, as soon as you sort us humans into 2 oppositional groups, it just brings out the worst in us.
Kelly talks with New York Times bestselling author Amanda Ripley about the kind of high conflict that destroys lives and ways to downgrade to healthy, productive debate.
I want to thank Karen Moon and all her clients, whose sharing was really the basis for today's conversation. I want to give love and accolades to Susan George, Dean Kateri, and Katie Davies, who make this whole thing come together week after week after week. And all of us want to thank JJ, Rebecca, Claudia, Christina, Gabrielle for posting beautiful reviews on podcast apps everywhere. We love seeing you on Instagram, so join me there at Kelly Corrigan for laughs and insights between shows. We'll see you next week with Kelly Corrigan Wonders.